It's just gone 8 o'clock in Washington, so it's time to start. Thank you so much for joining us from around the world for our second Global Parliamentary Workshop to mark the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. My name is Liam Byrne. It's my honour to be the chair of the Parliamentary Network for the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And it's my privilege to welcome you to this second workshop organised by the network this week. This year for the spring meetings, we've sought to organise our work in two halves. So yesterday we met together to recognise that the COVID vaccine gives us light at the end of the tunnel after what has been a truly awful year. However, we have to make sure that everybody gets to the end of that tunnel, safe in the knowledge that none of us are safe until all of us are safe. Today's workshop tries to take the debate on, and it tries to zero in on the question of our priorities now as we shift from lockdown to liftoff. We're going to hear from MPs from around the world about what they think about our priorities for the future in member countries internationally. And I'm delighted that we're going to be able to welcome two speakers from the IMF and from the World Bank to take your questions. So over the course of this morning, we'd love you to put some of your questions into the Q&A. And we're going to have a couple of polls that we'd like you to join in as well. These are anonymous polls, so feel free to speak your mind. At yesterday's workshop, we really saw how political leaders have got a monumental task ahead of them. In a way, what we're being asked to do is to pull off something of a five-card trick. First, we have to respond to the crisis. We have still got huge numbers of people who are ill, who are dying, and huge numbers of people still to vaccinate. But we also heard about how we have got together huge challenges in wrestling down unemployment. Nearly a quarter of a billion people, in fact, have lost their jobs. Second, we have got to rebuild health and education services. We heard how what has happened to children's education has been the worst education catastrophe for at least a century, something like $10 trillion in lost lifetime earnings because of the lessons that children have lost. Third, we heard about the challenge of how we're going to need to reallocate funds to new sectors. And fourth, we've got to begin redirecting investment into new growth sectors of the future, crucially, the kinds of infrastructure and energy systems, the kind of homes and industries that help us complete that roadmap of hitting the Paris deadlines and holding temperature rises down below 1.5 degrees. Now, we have to do all of that while remaining solvent. And what we heard yesterday is that we are going to come out of this crisis with sky-high levels of debt. In fact, something like $24 trillion have been added to global debt levels. Now, for many of us, we are wrestling with how on earth we contend with a collapse in tax revenues, the surge of investment into rescue packages that have been needed, and we now have to think about how we invest in a recovery that is stronger, fairer, and greener. These are going to be very, very difficult things to do, and it's therefore vitally important that policymakers together step up the kind of dialogue that we've had over this last year. Think hard about the lessons that we've learned and think harder about how we make sure that our partnerships with international financial institutions like the IMF and the World Bank aren't simply a return to the kind of approaches that we had before the crisis. We genuinely have to think anew about how we do things differently for the years to come. Now, to give us a little bit of a summary of yesterday, for those of you who weren't able to join us and for those of you who were there, but have perhaps forgotten all the details, I'm delighted to bring back on Zara Stasi, who has been our visual artist, who's just going to give us beautiful snapshot that she drew for us yesterday. And just take us through that, Zara, if you wouldn't mind, just to reprise yesterday. And for those who weren't able to join us yesterday, give them a quick overview of some of the issues that we discussed. And then, if it's okay with everyone, I'm going to put on the first couple of survey questions, which I'd love you to join in on. But Zara, thank you so much for that brilliant work yesterday. Just take us through what you did yesterday.
Thanks, Liam. Yes, of course. So yesterday I wanted to share the visual capture journey that we went on that echoes many of the points Liam just made. This is a type of tool that helps you to understand what we covered, but also share it beyond the folks in the meeting here today. So to start out yesterday, as mentioned, getting to the end of the tunnel, this was a conversation about equity, about how do we get all of us there. And what we started in with context around COVID-19 and the situation we find all of ourselves in, that public servants are really at the heart of the solution to this challenge, to getting us from pandemic to the Paris Agreement to the end of poverty. We spoke about this context, but really we're posed with a single question for the session. How do we build back fairer? What are those themes or areas that we should be spending time and effort on to build back fairer? So the first that we covered that the speakers really talked about and our question centered around was cooperation across policymakers. And this includes sharing learnings and really having that be a consistent thing that we focus on as we navigate these challenges. Similar to that theme, is building on the trust nationally and globally, and really using that cooperation to build trust and to focus on international collaboration and cooperation. This is something important for the future of the unknown, for how to stay prepared and ahead of what may come when we don't know what that is. So you see the unknown there before something strikes. Very paramount to that is the idea of proactive and clear communication, knowing what you want to share and how you want to share it, and being very proactive about that. And of course, we talked about that there is no trade-off between the economy and health of a nation, of a world. And we focus very heavily on the link between economies and vaccines, and the idea of, as Liam mentioned, everyone needs to be involved in this solution or else we really can't get there together. Vaccines need to be accessible for the economy to get back on track. One piece of this, as Liam mentioned, is investing in our future, and digital solutions came up time and time again as a potential solution, a potential equalizer to how we come out of this tunnel. It is not here consistently yet, but investing in digital solutions and closing the digital divide, especially when it comes to education, was one theme that came up time and time again. We also spoke quite a bit about where to reallocate funds to women, to children, to students in education, and then across sectors that are hit the hardest, which may be different country to country. Specifically, education and funding it should be a whole spectrum conversation, not just basic education, but technical education was also covered quite a bit as well. We also spoke about this whole project of getting to the end of the tunnel. It is definitely bolstered by international resources, but the social services that are needed across countries really need to be driven by domestic needs and supported by local policymakers before that impact can really take root. And the last piece of yesterday's puzzle was around focusing on the green recovery investment. So focusing again on our future and knowing that the green recovery and the green future and focusing on climate change as a huge global challenge is an area that we need to have front of mind as we focus on the next big steps, which we will talk about today quite a bit. Liam, I'll pass it back to you now, and I'll be excited to capture today's conversation.
Brilliant. Tara, thanks so much. Brilliant summary. And yes, look forward to seeing you a bit later on in our conversation today as you try and summarize the complexities of today's discussion. Now, we're going to ask you to join us in our first survey now. If I could just have the survey questions up on screen, please. Thanks so much. So these, this poll is anonymous, but we would love to capture your points of view at this stage on two questions. So first, what do you think is the highest priority for your country at the moment? Containing the spread of the virus, vaccine rollout, strengthening health systems, jumpstarting the economy. And then the second question is on a scale of 1 to 4, How concerned are you about debt levels in your country? So one, very concerned, through to three, not concerned. Option four, I don't know. Before we start, before we hand over to our brilliant speakers today to get today's conversation going, we're now just going to hear from some voices, Parliamentary Network members from around the world, who shared with us earlier some of their thoughts about the priorities that they see in their countries as we try as a world to get back on our feet. Let's see the video now.
Costa Rica debe enfocarse en la sostenibilidad, la inversión verde.
Costa Rica must focus on sustainability, green investment, renewable energy. For that, I have two bills in Congress that will help to prepare Costa Rican economy for the challenges of tomorrow. First, promote a strategy of carbon sequestration from the soil through the emission of bonds that facilitate transition to a green economy that will be resilient, low in emissions, promoting a change in paradigm in the route towards decarbonization, having assets that are more competitive in the markets. The second is to give securitization so that our energy resources can be clean, responsible, and so that we can obtain enough funds to meet the crisis and improve economic indexes, but also resources to develop environmental protection projects and also works related to that. My intention is to revert the consequences of climate change and fight against the greenhouse effects so that new generations can inherit a better country.
We must ensure that we do not go back to business as usual. Our lifestyle before the pandemic was simply not green enough, and therefore recovery must be seen as a green step forward, not a return to just what we had before. We must ensure that sustainable use of our resources, both at land and at sea, and to ensure the development of greener technologies. To insert some explicitly Danish-related points, perhaps the improve on the planning of the process of offshore wind farms, to include all relevant stakeholders and experts from the beginning, and to ensure that wind farms, while providing excellent green energy, are kept outside of the most vulnerable sea areas.
Hello, everyone. There is no better moment than now to start thinking about our future. Recovery alone is not enough. First, the COVID crisis highlighted the importance of applying more sustainable development models and joining forces to fight against climate change. We should enforce a stronger message on this. If we want to reach net zero carbon emission by 2050, we need to double our efforts. Second, each country should invest more in its public health system. This seems self-evident, but we should not ignore even the most obvious lesson. Ensuring the world has access to a better coordinated healthcare system should be a priority. Third, no progress will happen without skills. The post-COVID world will be more connected, and effective education policies will provide the resources for individuals to learn and acquire skills needed for a fast-changing workforce. If we work together, we will not waste the opportunity to achieve a greener, more inclusive recovery. Thanks.
From Liberia, the three priorities for greener, more inclusive recovery are 1. Building resilient communities through the provision of sustainable, renewable energies that will minimize the use of fossil fuel and ensure safe and clean environment. 2. Creation of good public health policy that will promote primary health care, nutrition, reproductive health, awareness to family doorsteps, helping families become knowledgeable in taking decisions that save their lives from preventable and treatable illnesses. And 3, provision of comprehensive social protection for all through good economic recovery policies and implementation modules, considering practical experiences from the 2020 pandemic lockdown period. And this requires parliamentary support to make internationally acceptable legislation for ratification by all governments for building a better world.
Malaysia has just implemented a solar project of up to 1,000 megawatt to accelerate the renewable energy target of 25% of energy mix by 2025. The project, which will add to the existing energy sources for electricity supply in Malaysia, generate more than $1 billion in new investment over the next 1 year and create more than 10,000 jobs over the period of implementation. Malaysia recently launched a comprehensive digital economy blueprint as part of the strategy to take the country out of the pandemic and fasten digitalization in Malaysia. The blueprint, which will cover the entire ecosystem in digital economy, will include the deployment of massive 5G infrastructure, the push for technological adoption within industries, and the funding for startups and innovations. This initiative is expected to create 500,000 jobs over 10 years and contribute to more than 20% of our GDP by 2025. Malaysia has developed a subsidy and incentive program to create new jobs, reskill and upskill those who lost their jobs. The program includes incentives equivalent to 20% of the employee's income for employment of the disabled, long-term unemployed and retrenched workers.
The first priority for Portugal should be to create a more competitive business environment that facilitates the recovery of the sectors more affected by the pandemic, namely tourism, but also induces a diversification of the economy into digital services through the improvement of STEM skills and into a zero-carbon transport system. Businesses also need lower taxes and better regulation, and that is associated with the second priority, a more efficient government and public sector. Finally, the third priority should be to reinforce social protection for young families and for the elderly, and to improve public health, focusing on the prevention of chronic diseases and on epidemic monitoring and surveillance.
When we talk about a greener and more inclusive economy, we are talking about a new growth model, sustainable, green, smart, and inclusive. We're talking about a growth model, people-centered, that generates wealth and well-being. For this, I see three necessary pillars. The first one would be access to health and education for everybody. The second pillar is a green economy, including green production of energy, transport, transmission, agriculture, and the new industrial policy that fits into the new concept of green economy. And the third pillar is the public sector reform. A public sector able to promote reforms, also to promote and implement digitalization.
So there we are, some perspectives from around the world to get our conversation started this morning. Now, there are just 10,500 days between now and April 2050, when we hit the Paris deadlines. And over that period of the next 10,500 days, global GDP is forecast to double. There should be enough wealth created over the next few years for us to fulfill that mission of ending poverty and for us to make the investments that we need to fulfill the obligations that we all signed up to in Paris. How we get through the next few years, however, will really dictate how we fare over the next 20 to 30 years. So to help us kick off this discussion about the priorities that parliamentarians see, I'm absolutely delighted that we have got Jürgen Vogele, Vice President Sustainable Development of the World Bank, and Jayla Parzabashilu, who is Director of Strategy, Policy and the Review Department at the IMF. Jürgen, Jayla, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to hand Jürgen to you first for your intro, and then Jayla, if I may come to you. And then we're going to begin taking questions from parliamentarians who are watching from around the world. If you've got questions you would like to flag, please just pop them in the Q&A function so that I can do my best as moderator to make sure that all our questions today get answered. But Jürgen, without further ado, let me hand the screen and the stage to you.
Thanks so much, Liam. Thanks for having us, both Jayla and myself, in this important debate. I mean, really inspiring video clips just now, also your own framing at the beginning of the session. You know, we have five major crises. Obviously, we have a health crisis, we have a climate crisis, we have a jobs crisis, We have an education crisis, and as Shayla will, I'm sure, talk about quite a bit, we have a huge debt crisis. What we don't need on top of that is a leadership crisis. That's my first message, I think. And that's why it's so good to have this conversation with all of you around the world, because you are now in the enviable or unenviable position or situation, and I think you talked a lot about this yesterday, that you will make choices. You will decide where countries go, where money goes, where policy goes, how technology will be integrated, whether or not kids go back to school earlier or later. And very importantly, in connection with a COVID challenge that we face, to what extent you will focus on prevention. I want to make this point at the outset. This is not the last zoonotic disease we will have to deal with. It will come again. This is not the last. It's a bad one, but it may not even be the worst that we're going to face, and it will come again. So it was mentioned by a couple of you already in the clips. We need to focus on prevention. This cannot repeat itself. So we need to act now to avoid perpetuating the kinds of things that lead up to these zoonotic diseases. Thanks for already also sharing. It was a nice graphic display of what you were discussing yesterday. I think your concerns about an uneven recovery, about in all the points that you've mentioned. Today, we have the opportunity to discuss what we can do to transform the current crisis into a green, resilient, and inclusive recovery. Several of the parliamentarians who've spoken in the video mentioned that. I strongly believe that if we take the right steps now, we can avoid a slow return, as was mentioned earlier, business as usual. And instead, we create our economies in a way that they are truly vibrant and socially and environmentally sustainable. And this does not have to be a trade-off. Let us be very clear. I just came off another session earlier this morning, an hour ago, where we had several ministers of finance from around the world talking about air pollution management. And the minister of, vice minister of finance from China made the point that it is very clear that that society, that economic development and environmental sustainability reinforce each other. They are not a trade-off. Even in a hugely industrialized country that's gone through very rapid development and faces huge challenges, the conclusion has been very clear, and you will be surprised if you look into it in detail, what is going on in that country. I actually don't think we have the option to go back to the situation before the pandemic. Because, as was also mentioned by one of your speakers just earlier in the video clip, COVID has shown the fragility of our societies and the deep inequality and exclusion in many of our communities. I think it was always there, but it was brought out so stark over the last 12 months, how deep that issue is. And our recovery needs to address these issues, or we risk leaving large groups of people behind and reversing the development gains. As we design the recovery, we also have to keep in mind that we're not dealing with a single crisis, and this was, we've just discussed. Climate change is no longer a future problem, but an urgent issue that we have to address with the same intensity and focus as COVID. If the current trends continue, and unfortunately we are still on the wrong side of the of the path, it will push 130 million more people into poverty over the next 10 years. Decades of work are being erased at the moment. 80% or more than 100 million of these people will live in what we call our IDA-client countries, primarily in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, and they will, many of them will move. And it will continue to result in natural disasters. They cost already about 18 billion a year. I'm sure many of you on the call live in countries where natural disasters have intensified over the past few years. Most of them are in low and middle income countries. These natural disasters currently cost firms about $300 billion per year, due to disruptions in energy, water, and transport. And they also cost households, every single individual in those affected areas, more than $90 billion per year. So even social safety nets and other measures that you take, at the end of the day, it's the poor people that pay the price for this. So we have to act very urgently on this. Climate change is having many other effects, including land degradation, water scarcity. These impacts, in turn, make conflict more likely and cause migration, as I mentioned earlier, of millions of people. So the opportunity we have now, as we think about a recovery from COVID, is the opportunity to redesign our programs and policies towards renewed development progress, sustainable job creation, and low-carbon resilient economic transformation. And we need to do this as efficiently as possible, because as you mentioned, this huge debt burden, every dollar counts. Every dollar that you spend, you need to think about much more carefully than in the past. The good news is that for every country, being more ambitious on climate and more generally focused on the sustainability of development is also more efficient and is good for economies and people. For every dollar invested in resilient infrastructure, $4 in benefits are generated. In total, that's a $4.2 trillion gain for the taking over the lifetime of new infrastructure. So building, designing, financing infrastructure going forward the right way in a resilient way has tremendous benefits going forward. And it's not only economics, it's also jobs. We can create more than 65 million new jobs globally out to 2030 in this. Then investing in landscapes and ecosystem restoration, which has been a little bit neglected or quite neglected in the past few decades, is a huge opportunity to improve rural incomes, raise agriculture productivity, protect irreplaceable biodiversity, which is another extreme crisis hitting us at the moment, and reduce vulnerability to drought and floods. These things are not only good for the environment, they do create jobs and they stimulate the economy. When one of the more important immediate changes that we can make, one that's clearly good for the economy and the environment and can be designed to maximize impacts on people, is redirecting existing financial support to specific sectors. Let me give you a couple of examples. As you probably know, countries around the globe are spending billions of dollars on providing financial support to energy and agriculture. According to the International Energy Agency, countries spend about $320 billion on fossil fuels alone, fossil fuel subsidies. And countries that produce two-thirds of the world's agriculture output provide around $600 billion per year in agriculture financial support on average. $600 billion, that's more than half a trillion dollars per year. That's more than all ODA and is more than a lot of money that's available dealing with stimulus packages for many countries. At the same time, agriculture generates 25% of the GHG emissions. So half of these emissions are the result of production processes, which generate mainly methane and nitrous oxide, while the rest are generated through the carbon that's released when forests and woody savannas are converted into agricultural land and through the degradation of peat areas. If we don't change anything in the way we produce our food, agriculture emissions currently that are at about 12 billion tons of CO2 per year will rise to 15 billion tons by 2050. And this is, you know, you briefly mentioned the energy sector where there is a transformation going on. Even in the transport sector with e-mobility and electric vehicles, et cetera, there is a transition and a transformation going on. In agriculture, we're not seeing this yet. And we must act on this. If we don't act, we will be using 70% of all the annual allowable emissions budget for all human emissions just to produce our food. And again, it doesn't have to be that way. We don't have to do this. It is actually possible to dramatically reduce the emissions from agriculture while still continuing the support and the people whose livelihood depends on it. We, of course, it's very clear that governments want to support their farmers and their agricultural sector. So we're not advocating to eliminate agricultural subsidies. But what we should be and what you should be talking about in your parliaments is how do you redirect those huge amounts of resources in a way that not only increase incomes, that's a given, but to improve and improve livelihoods, but do it in a way that's actually sustainable, that actually leads to lower emission and that leads to better health and nutrition outcomes by diversifying the sector. We believe that the food system needs the strong support of governments. And again, let me be very clear, we're not advocating reducing or eliminating agriculture subsidies, but they're currently given in a way that is not only not helpful, it's actually detrimental to the environment in many circumstances. There are some notable exceptions in the EU, and agricultural subsidies are beginning to shift towards better environmental outcomes, but it's still only 25% of the money that's actually given to farmers. So this is an important element in the policy conversation that you have. Support the sector and the farming community in a way that it actually creates public goods. So we're happy to work with you on this in country by country. We have engaged in a number of countries in this conversation. And again, there cannot be a conversation saying, oh, this is politically too sensitive. Actually, it isn't. If it's done right, you don't have the farmers on the streets. There are a number of examples where that has been the case. Now, one of the tools that we have been developing in the bank is what we call the RISE framework. And RISE is very similar to the GRID. It stands for resilience, inclusion, point has been made many times, sustainability, I've just talked about that, and efficiency, and that means every dollar counts. So by resilience, we mean the ability to take action to prevent shocks and to bounce back from them. We look at resilience of infrastructure, economies, and people. By inclusion, of course, we mean the different groups in the society that they have access to markets, services, and credit. By sustainability, we look at whether or not a country is using its natural, physical, human, and intangible capital in ways that doesn't harm the future capabilities. And finally, looking at efficiency, are the resources used in a way that maximizes returns to society while minimizing the financial, social, and environmental costs? So we used the RISE framework with many countries around the world to look at the country's strengths and weaknesses along these four dimensions, and then we can work together to on advice and policy and investment, how to get the best, the maximum return for the investment. Another important set of activities that we will be using to support countries to make sure their recoveries and development are green and resilient is our work on climate change. So let me brief you, and many of you may have heard that we just last week presented to our board of executive directors the outline of a new climate change action plan, which is bold, ambitious, and which will in a way change the way we interact with our clients, but certainly change the way we operate internally. One of the things we will introduce is the Climate Change and Development Report. It's essentially a country diagnostic that will help you understand and us understand the interplay between development, poverty reduction, growth, inequality, and climate change and climate policies at every country. We will look into how climate change and global decarbonization may impact the country's development path and priorities. And we will look for potential areas for country action in resilience, adaptation, and of course, mitigation, reducing emissions to improve development outcomes. We will also engage more strongly with everyone who is interested in the work on the NDCs and to see where there are the biggest returns in the NDCs and how they can practically be implemented and your long-term strategies. The Climate Change Action Plan will also help countries focus their reforms on five key sectors that account for over 90% of global emissions. And they're well known. It's the energy sector, which, as I mentioned, the agriculture and food system. It's the cities, the way cities decarbonize themselves, and it's the transport and the manufacturing sectors. Those five account for 90% of all emissions. We will help countries find ways of taking advantage of the global needs to transform these sectors, to modernize, create good jobs, and to make infrastructure, economies, and societies more resilient. We've also announced that we, as a World Bank group, will align our financing flows with the objectives of the Paris Agreement by July 2023. We need the two-year transition period because of some of the things that are in the pipeline, but more importantly, because there is no really universally agreed methodology for some of the things we finance as an institution, such as policy loans or how we interact through our IFC with financial intermediary banks, etc. So this, we need to work through this, but we have made clearly the announcement and the commitment to do that. We have confirmed that we will do 35% of everything that we finance climate smart. So there will be climate co-benefits, and we will have 50% of that climate finance reserved for adaptation. So with that, I took you a little bit through what's going on internally, but also how we think about a green, resilient, sustainable, and inclusive recovery. With that, I'm handing it over, if that's okay, Liam, I'm handing it over to Chela to hear what's happening at the IMF.
That's brilliant, Jürgen. Thank you so much. And what I thought was sophisticated and intelligent about the presentation is very clear recognition that we have to secure consent for some of these enormous changes that we're making. Farmers on streets are a political catastrophe. And therefore, as we work through the policy framework and towards a new model, bringing the people with us is obviously the thing that keeps us awake at night. So thank you for recognizing some of the political challenges of making sure that we make this transition without losers, effectively. Great. Right. With that, let me hand over to you, Jayla, for a perspective on some of these questions from the IMF.
Thank you very much. And it's really a pleasure to be here in this discussion and participate in the Global Parliamentary Workshop. We all stand collectively at a critical juncture with enormous opportunity to achieve a smarter and greener global economy that serves all, not just the few. And each of you in this virtual room has a very important role to play in helping us achieve this together. We just announced our revised global projections just now, actually. We now project 6% growth in 2021 compared to our estimates of 5.5% in January. This is good news, and in part, of course, due to exceptional measures taken by governments, including 16 trillion in fiscal action and massive liquidity injection by central banks. But a dangerous divergence in economic prospects within and between countries is becoming much more apparent. Many people continue to face job losses and unemployment, while countries face unequal access to vaccines, varying room for policy support. So we are seeing a multi-speed recovery, which poses challenges. Of course, a rapid recovery in the US will support global growth, but can also trigger a tightening of global financial conditions and prompt capital outflows from emerging markets and developing markets, which is developing economies, which is very critical in the context of some of the issues that we are going to discuss today. So we need to make sure that there's careful and structured policy communication and policy implementation by all. What needs to be done? So the key priority remains to basically safely exit the crisis, the health crisis, with a focus on ramping up vaccine production, distribution, and deployment. We always say at the fund, vaccine policy is economic policy, and faster progress in ending the health crisis could add almost $9 trillion to global GDP by 2025. And 60% of this goes to emerging markets in developing economies and 40% to advanced economies. So it's very important that we address dealing with the health crisis. As the pandemic recedes, we need to target policies, helping workers transition from shrinking to expanding sectors, helping workers adjust through retraining, reskilling, and withdrawing worker support, worker retention support gradually. It will be very important to ensure that countries have effective bankruptcy procedures in place, out-of-court settlement systems, and other mechanisms to mitigate an expected increase in corporate insolvencies. This is really critical to make sure that corporate debt does not end up becoming as contingent liability and add to sovereign debt. So we need reforms to mitigate economic scars and to promote a fairer and more inclusive transition. As was mentioned by all of the parliamentarians earlier on, as well as Jürgen just now, we need to invest in the future. The crisis has made the case for pandemic preparedness and more broadly for investing in resilience, especially to climate shocks. Our research has shown that a coordinated green infrastructure push combined with carbon pricing could boost global GDP in the next 15 years by 0.7% and create millions of jobs, which is really critical. And climate change has severe economic, financial, and distributional impacts, together with the scope to exacerbate fragility and volatility. At the fund, we are embracing the transition to the new climate economy, one that is low carbon and climate resilient, and one that fights the causes of climate change and adapts to its consequences. We are firmly integrating climate analysis in our surveillance activities. We are encouraging the largest emitters to engage with us on climate mitigation in the context of their Article 4 consultations. This is the surveillance mandate of the IMF, and 12 of the 20 largest emitters are already part of this process. We are also launching a new climate change indicators dashboard to improve data for policymaking and advice and helping adaptation and resilience building efforts through increasing our capacity development support, as well as expanding our climate change policy assessments. We, of course, have to also need to transition to the new digital economy. This will be critical. The pandemic has given digitalization a further push. A growing number of central banks are considering digital currencies, which could, of course, transform the international monetary system and has implications for global financial stability. And digital infrastructure investment could help transform our economic system, boosting productivity and living standards and financial inclusion. So we need to combine better infrastructure and greater access to the internet with investment in people's education and health. And this requires sufficient public revenues and national tax systems retooled for the 21st century. And this is very much, of course, of course, in the domain of the work of many of you. And this will mean making this more progressive and fairer tax systems. We must couple this with modernizing international corporate taxation through multilateral efforts to ensure that highly profitable firms pay their fair share when they do business. So what is, of course, ahead of us is that some will not be able to invest in the future compared to others. The pandemic is adding to spending needs at the same time as revenues are falling due to lower growth and trade. Debt burdens are building up. Vulnerable countries, including many low-income countries are facing higher financing costs or very limited access to external financing and are at risk of missing out on this once-in-a-lifetime transformation to a new global economy built on green and digital foundations. We just released new IMF research, which shows that low-income countries have to deploy $200 billion over the next 5 years to just fight the pandemic, and they need to deploy at least another $250 billion to return to the path of catching up to higher income levels. So the challenges are really comprehensive and calls for comprehensive effort by all. This means more domestic revenue mobilization, more external concessional financing, and more help to deal with debt. We have not seen a systemic debt crisis, and we want to keep it that way. No debt crisis has happened thanks to decisive policy actions by central banks, fiscal authorities, official bilateral creditors, and international financial institutions. But we should not sit idle waiting for a crisis. That's why we are taking very important steps to deal with debt. Debt transparency is, of course, critical for the recovery. Significant improvements in debt transparency will require concerted efforts by the official community, including creditor and debtor countries. And all stakeholders have to do their part to address debt problems. The debt service suspension initiative, which was called for by the managing director of the IMF and the World Bank president last March, has been very valuable for many of the poorest countries, and we support its extension for the remainder of 2021. It's good news that the G20 countries have agreed to act together. There's also the common framework for debt treatment, which will facilitate timely and orderly debt treatments for DSSI eligible countries with broader creditor participation, including the private creditors, the private sector, which has so far not participated in the DSSI. We are also encouraged by the support building among the IMF's membership for a possible SDR allocation of $650 billion, which could benefit all countries by boosting their reserves without adding to debt burden and free up resources for urgent needs. And we also are working on possible voluntary reallocation of SDRs from advanced economies or those that can afford it to lower-income countries, which really need this support. So as was mentioned by several MPs at the start, we cannot go back to business as usual. I'm going to end with a quote from Mahatma Gandhi. The future depends on what you do today, and I hope we can all seize this opportunity together and for all, not just for the lucky few. Thank you very much.
Jayla, that was a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much indeed. Now, we're going to just have a second survey now. If I can just have the second survey questions popped up now. These are anonymous. This poll is anonymous. So two questions we'd like to put to you watching from around the world. What do you think is more important at the moment in your country, investing in greener jobs or reducing unemployment levels? And then second, we'd love your point of view on this question. How could the World Bank and IMF support parliamentarians in your country achieving that greener and more inclusive recovery? So we'll just give people a minute or two to respond to those questions, and then I'm going to share with you the results through the magic of Zoom polls, just to get your perspective on it, Jayla and Jürgen. But just while we're waiting, I wonder if I could just put this question to you, and maybe Jayla, you'd like to pick this up first. For many of us in politics around the world, it feels like we're in the middle of a riptide. So on the one hand, there is the need for almost a double surge of fiscal and monetary support. We've got the emergency to respond to, plus we're trying to mobilize investment in a greener, fairer, stronger recovery. That's on the one hand. On the other, all of us are having to begin worrying now about fiscal consolidation in the years ahead. Now, I was a finance minister in the UK at the end of the great financial crash. Back then, when we looked at fiscal consolidations around the world, back to the early 1970s, we had a particular view about what were healthy or unhealthy levels of debt. But we also had a view that consolidation needed to be driven by public spending cuts rather than tax rises. Now, these two conflicts are a really significant political challenge for many of us at the moment. But I wonder if you could just maybe offer any kind of reflections on the timing of fiscal consolidation moves, whether we now think differently to the way we did 10 years ago about sustainable debt levels. And thirdly, what would you say about the tax spend mix today? Obviously, it will be different in different countries, but we had a particular view back 10 years ago. I wonder if that's moved on. Maybe Jayla, and then I could come to you, Jürgen, and I will put that poll down, and then we're going to present some results.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for that question. I think it's excellent. And this is very much the concern of many, as we discuss with many of the ministers of finance, the timing. There are different phases of this crisis. And the phases, unfortunately, we go back and forth among these different phases. So the timing is really very difficult to manage. In particular, given the implications of the health crisis on the economic crisis, it's very important that we address the health crisis. So we have been at the fund really putting a lot of emphasis on managing the health crisis and really doing whatever it takes to deal with the health crisis so that this minimizes the concerns for increased economic issues. But at the same time, really thinking about a medium-term fiscal consolidation effort. This is in parallel with addressing the pandemic. And in that context, the low interest rate environment obviously helps because the interest servicing costs, debt servicing costs are much lower than the last 30 years. Interest rates are projected to remain low, which makes it relatively easier to plan. But as you said, it's really critical to plan already now for the next phase. And that will include a different mix between tax and spending. So for many countries, it's going to be important to increase revenues, tax revenues. I mentioned a more equal and just tax system, and we have been working very much on that, including what we discussed earlier on going to a green recovery and the role of carbon prices and carbon tax. And we have written quite a lot on this at the fund. So I think we have to think about where we were before this crisis, which was very unequal, and how we are going to a system, a tax system, which helps us also to go to a more equal society.
Yeah, thank you. Useful. I think it was actually one of your colleagues, Carmen Reinhart, as well as Ken Rogoff, who published that wonderful book about 10, 12 years ago, which presented a pretty clear view about that high levels of debt were not necessarily great for growth. Do you think that perspective has changed a little bit now? Do we think about that a bit differently, Jayla?
I think what is very important is if debt is growth enhancing. Yeah. So it will be very important to make sure, unfortunately, we have many countries where 50% of investments are inefficient. So quality of public expenditures, quality of how debt is used is going to be critical. I like saying debt, I think of debt in three ways: good debt, bad debt, and ugly debt. And we have to make sure we don't have
like taxes, well. Actually.
Exactly. Where we need to make sure we have transparency. And we need to also make sure that there is that debt goes to good use, which is growth enhancing. So for me, that's really where we need to pay a lot of attention to.
Yeah. Great. Jürgen, what's your perspective on
this? Is really Ceyla's area of expertise. So I fully agree, of course, with what she said. But let me add, it's not only about the debt, it's also with the money that you already have in your coffers and that you are spending. I mentioned the combined $1 trillion a year that go to energy and agriculture subsidies.
Yeah.
Let us not forget that. You know, in good times, that's okay, right? Nobody wants to touch it because it's politically sensitive. These are not good times right now. It is really worthwhile having a conversation how to spend $1 trillion at the moment, like Ceyla was saying, you know, and I don't know which of the three categories it is right now. But some of it is not very helpful in terms of economic, job, and environmental and public goods returns. And I think it is worthwhile discussing it. And again, the point is not to say we're gonna reduce subsidies or we're gonna eliminate subsidies. That's politically not feasible, certainly not at this point. But you can redirect it and get a much better outcome for it. That we have seen and we have shown a number of countries around the world. So
I remember 10 years ago we used to have a saying, which is we knew what to do, we just didn't know how to get re-elected once we'd done it. And indeed, in our case, in the Gordon Brown government, that indeed is what happened. Right, let's have a look at the poll results, which I'm going to share with you. So here we go. So very interesting. So what do we think is the highest priority in your country at the moment? So vaccine rollout, clear number one there. On a scale of 1 to 4, how concerned are you about debt levels? Very concerned, 60%. These are much clearer answers, actually, than the polls we had yesterday. I wonder if we could get the answers to the third and fourth question that we asked as well. Very interesting. Okay, so what do we think is most important right now? Small majority for reducing unemployment levels. And then how does the World Bank and IMF support parliamentarians? Targeting country-level engagement, 72%. Clear winner there. Very, very interesting. I'm not entirely surprised. I mean, certainly we are, in our country, I can tell you, we're wrestling with this debate about how we recover and go green. And many people, many voters, the boss, in effect, they do see those two objectives as in tension. So people will often say to us, well, look, don't we need to recover first and then go green? Now, you know, in some countries, there's a lot of discomfort about that, but it is seen as a trade-off. And we have to create political solutions to squaring that circle. So, you know, in my part of the world, we talk about becoming a centre for green manufacturing, for example. That's how we, given our tradition here, square that circle between recovery and going green. But Jürgen, I wonder if I could invite you first just to sort of reflect on what you saw there with any particular observations.
Look, I mean, we have
maybe,
to...
Maybe pick up this tension between recovery and unemployment.
Yeah, I mean, we have to...
Recovery and going green.
We have this discussion on a daily basis, just like I'm sure it's happening in the fund as well, right? There is always those who say, oh, there is a trade-off, but, you know, we can't do both at the same time. We first have to get people back into jobs and then we worry about green, you know. And my view, my personal view is it's the opposite. The trade-off is not going green right now. That's where your real trade-off is. And this is spatial and temporal. There's always this, yeah, in the long term, green is better. No, there are lots of jobs that you can generate right now if you're creative and if you focus on it, that give you both. It is absolutely out there. And I think we need to seek it. We need to look for it. We need to, you know, purposefully embrace it rather than starting every conversation with, yeah, but there is a trade-off. And then, you know, like, okay, then now I don't have to worry about it because we all agree there is a trade-off. So let me first do what I would normally do. I just feel there is a switch has to be flipped in a lot of folks' mind. And yeah, when they get creative, you'd be surprised what will happen, right? Lots of new things come up and lots of new stimulus programs that all of a sudden have a very different feel and touch to them, that create excitement, that are more inclusive, that bring people in that you normally wouldn't even have thought about in the first place. and all these things are happening. So I'm missing a little bit the creativity. And because it's buried under this immediate knee-jerk reaction, oh my God, yeah, but there is a trade-off. We can't risk, you know, there's a risk. Well, if there is a risk, then address it, deal with it, you know, discuss it, talk it through, but don't give up before you've really looked at all the options that are out there. I often feel when we have the conversation in the energy sector, there is always this, you know, out of coal must be gas, right? Because we need baseload. So therefore, but there are also other options. And if you really have dig down, you'd be surprised how many other possibilities there are. So that maybe that's my message.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great answer. I know some of my colleagues at Nuffield College here at Oxford have done some really good work looking at the kinds of program measures that are both good for decarbonisation and job growth. And I think when we as parliamentarians talk about not going back to business as usual, this is one of those areas of advice that is going to be especially important to get across and help with policy design at the individual nation state level. Jayla, what was your perspective on some of the results there that we saw?
So just quickly on the trade-offs, I fully agree with both of you. I think this is there are trade-offs, and at the same time, one could get jobs. And I mentioned the green infrastructure push and how that could be really very important for growth. That said, some countries will face bigger trade-offs than others. So that goes back to what was said there, country-specific advice, really making sure that we understand the needs of each country and really focus our advice based on the initial conditions of each country and what they need to be dealing with. And some of the lower-income countries will face very difficult trade-offs as they adapt to the climate change and will require support from the international community. So I think it has to be a comprehensive package of measures, both in advanced economies and low-income countries. I thought that it was on the survey results, the emphasis on vaccine rollout is very important. As I mentioned, this is the key priority. We should all be focusing on making sure that there is access to vaccines by all, and we have to all do our part supporting COVAX and other mechanisms. This is number one priority that we all need to focus on. And I was also, I wasn't surprised to see 65%, I think it was, of representatives very worried about debt buildup in their countries. And this is true, we see it. There's also contingent claims through the corporate sector, through all the measures that have been taken by government. So these will be issues that we really have to focus on. We have been and really need to focus on how to deal with this debt overhang we have in many of the, unfortunately, in many of the countries.
Yeah, politics is a life of many drawbacks, but a shortage of challenges is not one of them right now. So we're going to open the floor now to some questions that have come in from our colleagues around the world. Please do pick up which of the questions you feel best placed to answer. But let's just run through the first three. So Adegnika from Cameroon asks about what are the urgent actions needed to ensure progress to eradicate extreme poverty is not wiped out? So that's a good broad question. Amar from Algeria, how do we make sure that the future is, well, how do we make sure we're more resilient to future crises? So Jürgen, you actually made this point that very well in your remarks that we're going to have this again. So making sure that we are better prepared, making sure that we've learned the lessons from what we've been through. And then Akua from Ghana has a quite a brilliant question, which is a challenge for the network as much as anything else. What can be done to build parliamentary capacity for participation in the Paris Agreement? Jürgen, do you want to have a crack first?
Yes, of course. The fact that more than 100 million people have fallen into poverty, that is the absolute minimum threshold, line over the past year is extremely disconcerting. And what you can do, I mean, one very, very important tool in the toolkit is the social safety nets and social protection programs. And we've actually seen some real progress over the last 12 months. I think before the pandemic, I mean, Jayla may know the number better than me, but I think only 1/3 of all countries around the world actually had a functioning social protection network in their country. That has now basically doubled. And then within each country, so there's been a huge investment in trying to find those people, you know, trying to get them a digital address, trying to connect and trying to get money into their pockets. And so we've seen that both an expansion, the breadth and the depth of these. And this has been a very, very important tool. I know it's short term, I know it's temporary, I know it costs money, but it has helped 100 million people to try to prevent the worst outcomes. So we've ramped up our program by about $20 billion over the last 12 months through various channels and instruments, the direct social protection being one of them, but food for work, cash for work, you know, community-driven development programs that transfer funding directly. Very, very important toolkit. And I think the world always needs to be ready to have that up the sleeve when something like this happens. It's not a solution to the underlying problem, but it is very, very important. The second one is investing in food systems. You know, very poor people spend more than half of the little money they have on food. If they don't have that, they go hungry. So we unfortunately estimate that yet another about 100 million people have been added to the group that is going hungry and at least once or twice a week, which is totally unacceptable. And unfortunately, we are projecting that over the next 12 months, this will double again. We're looking at over 200 million people who will be in that category new. And because food prices have gone up locally, not globally very much, but locally. And so this is very important to deal with this and on both sides. It's one thing you have your cash transfer program, but if you only get 10 bucks or 20 bucks a month and the food price is doubled, that doesn't get you anywhere, right? So you have to work on both of these angles. These are two of the very, very key factors. If I may make a brief comment on the other question, how do we prevent this from happening, right? So this is not the first time. We've been there before. I happened to live in Beijing during the SARS crisis. I physically stayed through the entire crisis in Beijing. So this is very personal for me. And also I led the World Bank response when the avian influenza was sweeping across the northern hemisphere and went down into Africa. So I've been very much involved in these zoonotic diseases. And the lesson is very clearly, these are preventable, not 100%, but significantly more than what we are doing right now if we implement a One Health system. And One Health policy and One Health systems, every country should adopt and should make it a high priority. It doesn't have to cost a lot of money, but it is important to have the underlying surveillance in place to see what's going on. It is important to have the diagnostic systems. It is important that ministers of health, agriculture, and environment have a standing committee and standing commission all the time, where they do come together, share information, and work together to prevent these things from happening. This is not just an East Asia phenomenon, right? And MERS came out of the Middle East. We have Ebola in Africa. There are a number of countries where the intersection between the way we treat or mistreat our environment by encroaching on wildlife in an ever-expanding way, the way we treat our food, or not treat our food well, and the health sector are you know, in sort of in a Stone Age kind of state, if you wish, right? And it really needs to improve and it needs to change. This is not rocket science. We are actually investing in the World Bank quite a bit in One Health, and it's not like it's not out there what needs to be done, but the problem is it's what we call, it's a sequence of panic and neglect. Every time there is a zoonotic disease, everybody panics. And then when we are done with it, this was the same with avian influenza, it was the same with SARS. 6 months later, when it comes to parliamentary discussion, yeah, we fixed that. That's okay. So what's the next problem, right? The fact is, though, they come every 5 years. And this one's a particularly bad one, but this may not be the worst we're going to see. If this coronavirus was more deadly, we would have an even worse situation. And it is possible. Look at Ebola, how incredibly deadly it is. It just is not very contagious. If a virus manages to have both, we're going to be in a much worse situation than what we are right now. And we know it, and you're still typically not acting. So my plea to all parliamentarians on the call is to do make this a priority. This is not costing trillions of dollars. This is not that complicated. And we have certainly the materials to work with everybody and share, you know, what does it mean to have a One Health system at a country that has the teeth and that has the ability to help prevent these things from happening? Back to you.
really important messages. I do feel that actually there are more politicians now who have woken up to the fact that this is going to happen again and again and again. I mean, partly just because of the number of mutations we've had from COVID and the new lockdowns that's had to trigger. I think people now realise that we've got to build systems that are future-proof.
Liam, if I may, when we were faced with the avian influenza, which of course was nowhere as deadly or as bad as this one is, we did put together a global program in the World Bank that allowed countries to access money very fast within 2 or 3 weeks, and not like a typical project cycle, because we created this global program, we went to the board, we had it approved, and then people could just come and countries could just come and sign up for it. And we ended up doing 72 projects in 62 countries. In 10 countries, we did it twice because they got hit twice by the avian influenza. And that actually really helped with the One Health ramp up. It improved diagnostics, surveillance, the thing. But then, 6 months later, it was like, okay, the interest waned and there was no more demand for this. And I think we have to maintain that demand. Every country needs to feel not only responsible for its own people, but for everyone else on the planet. Because as was said before, if not everyone does it, everyone has a risk and will suffer. Right? This is something that we collectively need to do. This is even more collective than climate change. If the key emitters solve their emission problems, it doesn't really matter what many of the other countries do, right? That are not emitting right now. But with this one, every country matters. So this is a particularly wicked challenge, but it's not complicated and not super costly to fix. Thank you.
Yeah, brilliant.
Can I add to this, Liam? Thank you. Yeah, so I think this crisis was also a very important reminder of the lack of the effectiveness of some public service delivery. So this really requires improvements in many countries on education, health. I mean, basic public service delivery has to really, social safety nets really needs to improve. So this was actually a very different crisis than, of course, the global financial crisis. And in many of our support programs, financing programs, we really put emphasis on making sure that there was actually a floor on spending for social needs, making sure that there was protecting social spending for many countries. So that was a big change in terms of IMF advice as well as IMF work. There was a question about how do we make sure that we can take action to make sure that we don't lose the fight on poverty, which I think is really very important. And it also, this is really critical to also make sure that we are more resilient to future crises, because mostly it's the poor that gets most impacted by crisis, be it economic crisis, health crisis, or otherwise. So I will come back to the point of really making the tax system more progressive, raising capital gain tax rates, ensuring highly profitable firms are appropriately taxed, closing loopholes, and importantly, ensuring that tax systems are enforced, especially for wealthy taxpayers. So I think this is going to be really important, and we need a systemic approach to improving tax capacity. And international community needs to step up that to ensure that countries can finance critical spending. This, of course, requires more grants, more concessional financing, and in some cases, additional debt relief, reprofiling, and restructuring of debt, coming back to some of the issues we discussed earlier.
Hopefully, I'm now back online. My internet here in the UK just cut out. I'm going to pick up the next set of questions now, and you're going to know you need to leave in a few minutes, but let me just rattle through these. So Abu Bakri from Senegal asks, is it true that due to climate change and deforestation, tropical forests are now becoming less and less effective? Carbon sinks. We've got a great question from Retta in Bahrain. What tools support is made available to developing countries to plan the move towards green economy post-pandemic? I know Jürgen, the World Bank has just produced an excellent report on this. And then Rita from Morocco asks about what mechanisms can enhance South-South cooperation and coordination in difficult global health crises. Supplementary question there about, do we think that digitalization will widen the gap between high-income and low-income countries? Jürgen, perhaps I could come to you first, because you might want to pick up some of those questions and offer some concluding remarks before you have to depart at 15:15.
Well, thank you. Well, let's not get down on the trees, right? I think the trees are a huge part of the solution, right? I mean, science always evolves, and it's not all green in the same shade. Let me put it that way. There are very important forests on Earth that need to be maintained if we want to keep the carbon where it is. If we release that carbon, it will make an unacceptable additional contribution to emissions that is absolutely not desirable. And it continues to be a major carbon sink. But let me also make the broader point. It is not just about the forests on this planet. It is about the way we manage our landscapes. That includes forests, but it also includes agriculture. I mentioned agriculture before. You can do food production and agriculture production in a landscape in a way that is actually carbon positive. It doesn't have to be an emitter. Right now, the way we've done it, and historically we've done it, we have never thought about this, actually. That's why we are, you know, we've just done it traditionally in a way, never paying attention to the carbon balance in it. But if we do agriculture right, and it's, again, not that difficult, we can have a carbon positive sink effect. And that, of course, includes managing the trees in the landscape. For our colleagues from the African continent, the future of food production in Africa is an agroforestry system, in my view. It is not the same type of forestry that you find in the Midwest of the United States or in Europe or in some other countries. It's ideally suited to have a combination of both, where you have a win-win, where you have a better environmental outcome and you have high productivity. So I'm no issue on that side. What was the second one? So what instruments do we have, right, in terms of working with a country? As I mentioned, the RISE framework, if that's okay. This is the Resilient, Inclusive, Sustainable, and Efficient Recovery. It actually has 5 or 6 indicators in each one of those buckets. And what we're doing is we're doing diagnostics country by country. We're now at, I think we've done about 8 or 10 now, together with our colleagues in the country, try to understand what are the trigger points, what are the kinds of areas where with a policy tweak or with some investment you can really make a difference. On the resilience side, what is the most effective way of doing these things? So I'm happy to follow up and send you a link to that kind of analytical and diagnostic tool. It is one of those that flies off the shelf, which doesn't always happen with our publications. Some are less less hot, but this one has gotten a huge amount of traction because it feels very practical. You really, you know, like in a real political or policy context, you can engage in these debates. So if I have to make choices, if I have to spend the next, you know, $20 million program, where do I get the biggest return when I look at this RISE? This resilience, where is it most inclusive? Where is it giving me the biggest return on the sustainability side? So it's a quite a methodical way of thinking through things. It also gives you a snapshot of where you stand as a country. It's actually very interesting. So you do a diagnostic, and then you talk to the Minister of Finance and say to her, so see, like out of the 5 different buckets that, or 6 different buckets that we looked at, you're doing really well on those 2, but you're actually not doing quite well compared to others in those 3 areas. And here is what you could do to catch up or to do something that is really, you know, moving you forward on that trajectory. So that gets a lot of good interest and feedback. Yeah. So I'm happy to share that.
And any views on South-South cooperation and coordination in some of the health crises that we can perhaps look forward to?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, right? So South-South is hugely important in development. We're working with Brazil, we're working with China, we're working with India, we're working with many countries to try to share experiences. As I said, I just came from an event on air pollution before this session, where ministers from countries around the world were working with South Asian ministers to share their experience. We had the head of the Mexican air quality authority, we had China, we had a number of other countries. So that South-South kind of exchange is most helpful. And right after I'm leaving you here, we have the Minister of Finance coalition around climate, speaking for 2 hours around. And that's the same. It's peer. It's not south to south. It's peer to peer. It's, yeah. We have like, you know, nearly 60 ministers of finance now, including the US has just joined. China hopefully will join, and we have many other countries. And the sole purpose is to exchange experience, including what you sort of said at the beginning. You know, politically, some of this is really hard, but that's exactly what you want to, where you want to share experience. Like, how was it that you were able to change agriculture policy in your country without people on the street? And, you know, why did they show up in Delhi, right? And so what is to be learned from this? How can this differently? I think that's a very, very powerful instrument. And I think your network, parliamentarian network, is hugely important in this context. And I've actually interacted with a network several years ago when I was director of environment around the WAVES, that's Wealth Accounting for Ecosystem Services, sort of the parallel to the GDP, like where you actually internalize the externality cost. And that was very, very welcome. And the South to South was a very powerful way of, or the peer to peer was a very powerful way of interacting and learning.
Yeah, so wonderful. Well, look, thank you, Jürgen. So, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to seeing you again soon. And let me just hand the floor now to Jayla for any observations on those questions.
Thank you, Leo. Thanks to everybody. All the
thank
best.
You so much, Jürgen. Thank you. Jayla, over to you. And then I'm going to bring in our visual artist, Zara, for her reflections on what she's heard today. But Jayla, over to you.
Great, thanks. And I also have to run to the same meeting, which is really That's a great right. way to bring everyone together on this coalition. Just very briefly, I think it's really very important on South-South cooperation, both on the issues related to green, but also the question that was asked about digitalization and the gap that is widening. There are several countries which are making incredible progress. India is one, Kenya is another one, both in terms of access to finance, financial inclusion, but really making use of digitalization. So I think there is very important and very important to have the South-South collaboration, you know, sharing experiences, learning from each other. And this is a key part of our work as international organizations as well. On some of the issues that were raised, I just want to also use this as an opportunity to just underline some of the issues that I mentioned. I think I want to leave with four issues. One, a green investment stimulus will really boost output and employment and prepare the ground for transition to a low economy. So this is, as long as, and if this is coordinated in green investment stimulus, this actually magnifies through the multiplier effect. So that's very important to have collaboration on this. Pre-announced progressive increases in carbon prices will really help efficiently allocate new private investment to clean energy and, of course, mobilize valuable revenues. We estimate about $1 trillion for advanced economies alone. And to ensure that we have a just transition, the governments should use part of the carbon revenues to, of course, compensate affected households and support job transition from high carbon to low carbon sectors. And the vulnerable countries need to adapt to climate change and integrate disaster risk and resilience spending into their macrofinancial and fiscal frameworks. And this does require financial assistance, external assistance, and therefore really a need for the multilateral community to come together and to support all in this very important goal. Thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss these issues. Really appreciate it. Can't hear you.
Thank you so much indeed for joining us. That's been a wonderful presentation, and we're very much looking forward to seeing you again at some of our sessions in the future. And actually, I think one of the ideas that you offer is, I think we are going to need a conversation about tax as well as carbon pricing as we head into this year. And that may be an opportunity for us to team up with our colleagues at the OECD as well, who I know have been doing lots of good stuff on this. But Jayla, for now, thank you so much indeed. Much appreciated. So the clock is slightly against us now, but thank you so much to everybody who has put in questions into the chat. We will make sure that you get a full written answer to those. Please, as well, just keep your eye on our digital platform, parlnet.org. We've put this in place over the last year to make sure that as parliamentarians, we have got a platform where we can share ideas, not just about the economics and the policy design that we need to think about for the future, but also some of the political lessons that we're learning as well. So Zara, you've been listening in on that. Thank you so much for staying with us and for joining us. Why don't you just sort of take us through what you heard today?
Will do. Let me get my screen up for you to view.
There we go.
And I'll take you right through. All right, so yes, today we focused quite a bit on the priorities. So we focused at the beginning of the conversation about what will help us design green, inclusive, resilient futures together. And we can't really do that without considering all the crises that are happening at the same time, even previous to COVID, obviously, whether that is education, climate change, our jobs crises, health crises, exacerbated by this last year and the challenges that it brought. So to address some of these, we talked quite a bit about the priorities that folks are focused on and those that are focused on the future. So, for example, the health crises, many countries prioritize the vaccine rollout that's still happening and still very much front of mind. But we also learned a bit about a One Health approach and how proactivity and focused on kind of consistent communication around a country's health is a way in the future to future-proof the focus on health crises. Across all of these pieces, people-focused recovery really seemed paramount while going green. So focusing on the people and the needs now, but not separating that from the needs of the future, including going green, and how that really just takes a little bit of creativity and obviously some trade-offs, which came up across some of our other topic points. Across these topic points, two areas of the climate economy and the climate infrastructure of the future came up. The first was around a coordinated and comprehensive climate economy approach that may include carbon pricing, future job training programs, green infrastructure, but of course may require really thoughtful trade-offs depending on where your country is. We also mentioned and talked through how unemployment and really that being a priority for many countries, a climate economy and a green economy can help to stem that unemployment, can help to address that unemployment. So again, people-focused recovery while going green. We also spoke quite a bit about the agricultural systems, the food systems, and how they may hold the key to better sustainable outcomes as well as healthier futures for the people. Specifically talking about how lower emissions and even carbon positive farming can have really positive effects on not only the economies of these nations, but the people in them and the workers in them. And we closed and spoke quite a bit about modernizing global taxation. So again, would welcome another conversation on that because I think you're right, Liam, there's so much to unpack there. But I thought it was interesting when we talked about how debt should be growth enhancing. So there's all different types of debt, just like there's all different types of taxes, but good debt is one that's focused on the growth of an economy and of a nation. And then as far as focusing on areas to prevent this from happening in the future, and this being, you know, the multiple crises that are happening right now, in addition to the One Health approach that was spoken about, proactive health understanding of a nation, there was also talk about investing in social safety nets and being very thoughtful and focused and proactive about what social safety nets your country has and how to proactively invest in them now, as well as investing in social service delivery. We talked quite a bit about how the breakdown of that social service delivery could be felt across many of our countries, but investing in that proactively will help stem crises in the future. So with that, this document, this conversation visual will be something that we'll share with you and you can use to remember this conversation as well as share with others to help bring them along on your journey from lockdown to liftoff. Liam, I'll pass it back to you.
Zara, thanks so much indeed. That's been a beautiful summary of our discussion today. And I do hope that everybody watching around the world will be able to share some of those images, both yesterday's and today's, with others. This brings our second workshop to a conclusion now. So I hope that you found both yesterday and today as valuable as I have. Over the course of this year, it's our goal to organise a few more of these sessions. Now that we have got this technology just about working, we hope to use this platform to continue bringing parliamentarians together, together with the IMF and the World Bank, and increasingly with other partners as well. So we have already organised some successful sessions with the World Health Organization. There may well be, based on the discussions that we've had this morning, a further session that we might want to think about with our colleagues in the OECD, who have done an awful lot of good work on tax. I think it's really clear that there is a really important job of work for us all to do together, continuing to stay in touch, continuing to share good practice, continuing, crucially, to share some of the lessons that we have all learned over the last year. I know that in our country, in the UK, in many fields of policy, we've had to innovate faster in the last year, do things more differently in the last year than we have in some cases in the last 10 or 20 years. We've learned an awful lot under the pressure of this crisis. So we need to be together drawing out the things that we've learned. We need to be making sure that we share those lessons with each other. And crucially, we need to continue the dialogue with international finance institutions about how their programs need to adapt at the country level in order to help us navigate some of the enormous challenges that still lie ahead. I hope that you found today valuable. We would love your feedback. We would love your thoughts and comments. If you would like to contribute blog posts to our digital platform, parlnet.org, we would love to hear from you. Ultimately, this is a team effort here at the Parliamentary Network. We can only share ideas if you're feeding those ideas into this dialogue. So that brings our session today to a close. It's just left to me to thank the translation team for the fantastic work that they've been doing at Interpretify, to Gagana and Philippe, our team at the Parliamentary Network, along with Sholto Malud, Hannah, Blythe, Elizabeth, Steve, and indeed to Zara Stasi, and to everybody who is working with you. Just a huge thank you for helping make sure that our workshop yesterday and our workshop today have gone so smoothly. We're hugely grateful to you. The final thing that I just want to share with you is for young members of Parliament, tomorrow at 8:30 Eastern Standard Time, we have a focus on using technology for good governance. We'd love to see you there. For those of you who are wondering what a young member of Parliament is, a young member of Parliament is under the age of 40, but we have a great and growing network of young parliamentarians who are working with us, and we'd love to bring you together at 8:30 tomorrow, Eastern Standard Time. That's it from me. Do let us know your feedback. Do stay in touch with the other events that the World Bank and the IMF are organising over the course of the week. Do let us know what we can do to continue to improve our work on these platforms. We would love to hear from you. But for now, thank you so much indeed for joining us this morning. Have a good rest of the week. Bye for now.